This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
You're listening to the AND Campaigns Church Politics Podcast, where you can get in-depth political analysis from a biblical worldview. We're not trying to be progressive or conservative. We're trying to be faithful Christians in the public square.
This is the kingdom. The kingdom. Yes, it is. Gotta spread the word.
What you know, good AND Camp, you're listening to the AND Campaigns Church Politics Podcast with Justin Gibney, that's me, and the Windy City representative, the baddest brother above the Mason-Dixon line, the Right Reverend Christopher Butler. What's going on, Chris, man? How is the weather in Chicago?
Well, it's second winter now. We had first spring, and now we're having second winter, so it's cold and a little bit of snow, but permanent spring should be here in about a week.
So the weather pump faked you.
Just a touch. I'm used to it. We usually get a first spring, then second winter. So I was ready for second winter, but looking forward to permanent spring.
Got you. Well, if you're ever feeling down, just know that in Atlanta, we're around the 60s, high 60s, low 70s, man. So that may make you feel better. We're with you in spirit, though.
I check it out and become envious every now and then.
Oh, man. Well, for those of you who have been following this podcast for a while, you know we've talked a few times about the Equality Act. The Equality Act is an act that sets out to give LGBTQ folks some rights that they should have and deserve. Unfortunately, it's a little bit excessive, maybe a lot obsessive, and it doesn't consider faith organizations at all. It doesn't consider people's conscience at all. And it really is a product of a system where one group writes down everything they want and pushes something through rather than kind of sitting down and figuring out how we can coexist. Fortunately, there's a better alternative, which is the Fairness for All Act, which is really comes from what was called the Utah Compromise, where in Utah, Mormons came together with the LGBTQ community and really did the hard work of finding how they could coexist. And what they found was that religious liberty and LGBT rights weren't in conflict, that they could actually find a way where everybody would be better off. That's what we need to do. And that's what the AND campaign has been advocating for. So while the Equality Act has been kind of pushed forward, we've been saying that America needs to do better, that America needs to sit down and have a conversation and act like we're a pluralistic society that we claim to be. So there's a hearing in the Senate coming up for the Equality Act. It's probably happening today while you're listening. And we drafted an article. We drafted a letter, rather, to the U.S. Senate saying that they should take a look and have a full hearing and support the Fairness for All Act, which is a much better alternative. This is a letter that me and Chris spent a lot of time on, and we had some great faith leaders sign on to it. I mean, we have a former ambassador that signed on to it. We have the former executive director of the Congressional Black Caucus. We have tons of faith leaders that signed on that said, yes, we love our LGBTQ neighbors, but we also want to make sure that we protect faith organizations, because one of the things that could happen from the Equality Act is even something like school lunches. A kid that attends a Christian school that doesn't want to change its convictions would lose the ability to get federally funded school lunches. That's not something that we want. And so we wanted to step up and say, where's the love and also where's the conviction, and really find ways to do this democracy thing and living together thing better. Any general thoughts on that back and forth, Chris?
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad that we put that letter in. And I really hope that folks will give a fair hearing, at least to the Fairness for All Act, especially given that there's probably not going to be enough energy in the Senate to pass the Equality Act. And there shouldn't be, because it's going to hurt people unnecessarily. But there is a way to actually move the ball on an area of public policy that's very important. Real people are hurting in real ways. And so anybody who's saying that they are an advocate, a defender, or an ally with LGBTQ rights, and won't give FFA a real hearing, I think that that action is going to compromise those commitments, or at least the integrity of those commitments in a real way, because this is real change. And to just push it aside is not going to serve the community that we're supposed to be advocating for in that instance.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And that's all we're asking for. Let's do democracy right. Let's have a pluralistic society where we sit down and try to figure things out and do the hard work of political or policy compromise and actually coming together to see where these things can fit together. Too many times we just assume that two things can't work together because they may have two different constituencies who disagree. But we found in history over and over again that if we work together, we sit down and try to get it right, that we can get it right when people come to the table in good faith. And so that's what we're asking for. We thank all those faith leaders that signed on to that letter. And we're hoping that it gets into the right hands and that people really consider it and give Fairness for All a full hearing. Well, we're about to get into it. That's just the beginning of this conversation. So as always, grab your Bible, get your mind right, and prepare to think not like a Republican, not like a Democrat, but like a Christian. Marco Rubio. I'm sure you guys have heard that name. Marco Rubio is the senator from Florida. He was the 2016 GOP presidential, one of the 2016 GOP presidential candidates. He's had a very interesting career. He's a Cuban-American Christian from Miami. He's an attorney who started his career as a member of the West Miami Commission. He won a seat in the Florida State House of Representatives, where he became the majority leader and the Speaker of the House by age 34. That's impressive. He won one of the senatorial seats in Florida in 2011, and he's in the Senate as we speak. He really, Chris, was a political phenom to some extent. I mean, to accomplish all that by 34 is a lot. And I myself saw some potential in Rubio for a time. He really did appear to be one of those politicians that you would be able to vote for who was outside of your party because he was bringing something different to the conversation. And I tend to look for those people too, right? I don't just look at my own party. I look for people on the other side that I can actually support. And I would recommend that folks listening would do that too. Don't just be stuck on your side, man. There may be somebody better on the other side. One of the things he did was he stuck out his neck. I mean, he was one of the Gang of Eight that was trying to get comprehensive immigration reform passed. Now, they fell short and he really paid for it. I mean, this is, you know, during a time where you're talking about the Tea Party and where folks were just not trying to see anybody work with the other side. So he ended up not only, you know, did it not pass, but he actually ended up in a lot of ways backtracking from the position that he had as one of the members of the Gang of Eight because the backlash was so strong. One of the other things that I appreciated is he also came up with a fairly strong policy paper on student debt. And this was a conversation that we've needed to have for a long time. And this policy paper basically showed how pumping loan money into the industry only costs these universities and colleges to raise the tuition, even as their degrees lost value. And so that's why you see all these people with all this student loan debt is because they were pumping loan money into it because it sounded good. But then they were just, you know, raising the tuitions and there was nothing to prevent that from happening. It was just bad policy. But I guess either it sounded good or the elected official who was pitching it looked like us. So we just went along with it. And many of us are paying for that today. Now, during this time, he was kind of being advised by this group that were being called the Reformicons, who are actually challenging a lot of Reagan era economic orthodoxy in the Republican Party. And I was impressed by just how they were coming up with so many different ideas that were outside of what you would expect Republicans to come up with. I didn't agree with all of it, but I do appreciate when people kind of step out of the box and try to solve problems in a different way, especially where we've been failing over and over again. And these were some of the guys who were kind of advising Rubio. And so it made it even seem a little more promising. he seemed at one point to have very good political instincts and clearly had political talent. However, in my eyes, his star started to dim around the 2016 GOP primary. As you guys may remember, it was a loaded field, and he entered into it even though it apparently caused a rift between him and Jeb Bush. Him and Jeb Bush had a relationship. Jeb Bush was the governor of Florida, I think, while he was the Speaker of the House in Florida. And so they built a relationship. I guess Jeb thought that meant he wouldn't run. And Rubio was like, I think again. And he was doing pretty well initially. I know a lot of folks had high hopes. I had a really good friend who was kind of on his team and helping him raise money and all that stuff. But it really started going downhill when Trump started mocking his hand size and calling him Little Marco. Unfortunately, Rubio responded in kind, and I think that was pretty much the beginning of the end. Not to mention, he pretty much got crushed in a debate against Chris Christie. Chris Christie really came at him. There are a bunch of folks there, but Chris Christie and him really went at it in a very almost unforgivable debate on February 6, 2016. And I study debates, and it was just a really bad performance by Rubio. He got stuck on one of his talking points and kept repeating himself over and over again, and Christie just pounced. And it was ugly. I'm sure he lost some sleep over that one. But I think the most disappointing thing was once Trump got into office, Rubio seemed to compromise himself over and over again to stay in the good graces of Trump and in the good graces of that Republican base. He did what most of the GOP did during the Trump years, and he did what Democrats do when it comes to abortion. He went into self-preservation mode, and he rode the wave while the American discourse reached breathtaking lows. Again, in my opinion, it was shameful. I don't think he ever really agreed with Trump from the folks that I know that knew him. That seemed to be the case. But it doesn't really matter because he didn't stand up. And so whether you agree or not, if you go along with something, it doesn't matter what you think inside if you're not professing it with your mouth. Sounds familiar. But Rubio, like many in the GOP, seems to be trying to find his way and his voice in this post-Trump or kind of post-Trump era. So he wrote an op-ed in the USA Today entitled "Amazon Should Face Unionization Without Republican Support." It said Amazon is waging a culture war against working class values and is not helping workers or our economy. He goes on to say, he says, for decades, companies like Amazon have been allies of the left in the culture war. But when their bottom line is threatened, they turn to conservatives to save them. Republicans have rightly understood the dangers posed by the unchecked influence of labor unions. Adversarial relations between labor and management are wrong. They are wrong both for workers and our nation's economic competitiveness. But the days of conservatives being taken for granted by the business community are over. Chris, I want to hear your thoughts on this article. You know, this was an interesting pivot, in my opinion. It kind of had something for everybody. He was siding with workers, kind of, and then he was fighting against the elites, Amazon, and their assaults on conservative cultural values. It seemed populist, but then not really. It certainly wasn't a full-throated endorsement of unions, as we can see. It was mostly aimed at Amazon, who I think in some instances deserves the criticism. We already talked about how they're censoring books, and I do think they're wrong for what they're doing to the unions. What was your thought on Rubio and just this pivot that he seems to try to be making after the post-Trump, in the post-Trump era?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of like how you laid out the background, I appreciate that, because I think you do see Senator Rubio trying to find his way. I think that he seems to be trying to move in a direction, albeit slowly and perhaps only to serve his own political ambition, but certainly moving toward this idea that I think is a very real idea right now in our politics and our political discourse, which is that the old way of doing it, this kind of like simple left-right binary, it just won't hold, and it won't take us into the next place where we need to be in our political discourse. You know, this line, I think is really telling, and you read it. Conservatives, the days of conservatives being taken for granted by the business community, are over. And it is a reality that a lot of the folks, you know, these very progressive, socially progressive billionaires and large corporations, they actually can, in a lot of ways, get really conservative on you when it comes to economic justice and labor justice. We talked some time ago about the NBA and the Uyghur people and in China, like these organizations that put themselves out there so progressive when it comes to their own money can get very conservative on you. And I think it should be an opportunity for all of us who engage in politics to move, I think, more quickly than Senator Rubio is moving in this piece, because this piece still, in my opinion, is kind of equivocated. You know, it's like, you know, we're going to be against labor as long as, you know, corporations are with us on social issues. I don't know if that's the argument. It is unclear. But that point that we cannot allow political parties or kind of ideological tribes to take our participation for granted. I think there's some learning there for those, you know, those of us in the Black church, for those of us in any church. There are things that we care about that are important to our identity, our way of life, our faith, that we profess, believe, and live by, the core to who we are, and they're not being expressed in our political party. They're not being expressed in our ideological tribe. And we need to be willing to put pressure on our own political parties, on our own ideological tribes, to say, you know, we have a voice in this, and we're not going to just give you a vote, give you our money, give you our platforms, give you, you know, all of what we have to contribute in the civic space. We're not going to just give it to you because we're, you know, quote unquote, on the same team. So this kind of, you know, as equivocating as this piece is, and it is very equivocating in my opinion, it does show that I think the whole political discourse is going to just keep moving in this direction where that old school left-right binary is not going to hold and not going to help us deal with the issues that we will have to deal with as we move into the future.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, you said in one word what I was trying to get out in several, which was this was equivocation, right? He was kind of floating some conservative populism out there, but not enough to kind of make mad some of the establishment folks or business folks that might be a part of the Republican Party and who he might need their support. So that was interesting how he kind of tried to work that in. It still is a pivot. We'll see how people respond to it. And he may be waiting to see how people respond to it. Maybe he goes deeper in, but he certainly didn't go all the way in, right? He certainly didn't kind of lead the way and say, I'm turning the corner and this is going to be completely different. It gives him the ability to do so. He put a few different narratives out there and we'll see where it goes. But you also made a very good point about Amazon picking and choosing when they're going to be woke and what they're going to do. And usually the bottom line, as Rubio said, is their pockets, right? They're woke. They can censor books and they can do all the things people ask them to do when it doesn't hurt their pockets, when it only helps their brand. But then they'll don't want to pay their workers very much, which is not very woke or populist at all. Right. Then they don't, you know, they don't want to allow their workers to unionize so that they can have some negotiating power to get paid more. These are conversations that we need to have. And it's a perfect example of this kind of corporate wokeness that we've been talking so much about. Right. Doing with it, having your cake and eating it too, just picking picking things that you want to be woke on and leaving others aside. And folks are going to continue to do that. Corporations are going to continue to do that as long as people let them get away with it. And if we're only focused on these narratives, we're only focused on this certain group or that certain group being the bad guy, then we miss a lot of what's going on. So there was some substance in what Rubio was saying. But as you mentioned, it was equivocating. And I think he's going to have to flesh that out and actually make some commitments and take a chance. And that's one of the things I think has hurt his star, so to speak, is that he hasn't seemed to want to take any chances since that Gang of Eight and since he got hurt from doing that. So just a conversation, something to look at. Let's see if others will take this up and maybe he goes a little further next time. But let's take a quick break and then we'll be back with the Church Politics Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
And we are back with the Church Politics Podcast. Justin Gibney, Chris Butler. Many Democrats have long said that demographics are destiny, meaning America is becoming more diverse. Therefore, the Democrats are bound to control the future. I've always thought that was lazy. I've never thought it was that simple. But apparently, Democrats aren't the only people who think that, because it seems to me that Republicans agree with that thought, too. And maybe that's why some of them don't want everybody to vote. After the GOP took L's in states like Georgia during the last presidential and senatorial elections, many Republicans on the state level began to propose voting reform legislation. This ostensibly was about making the elections more secure from voter fraud, or more likely, it was about appeasing a base that still thinks that the election was stolen. Hashtag stop the steal. There's multiple bills around the nation, and you know the Republicans control more state houses, but there's multiple bills across the nation. Some of them are restricting, you know, they're not allowing absentee voting without an excuse. Others are limiting weekend voting. These are some of the bills that you'll see in a state like Georgia. This is going on where I'm at right now, where they're saying, hey, we don't want so much early voting on the weekends, especially when we talk about Sunday. Now, as a Black Christian that goes to a church that people do vote on those Sunday voting days after service, you almost feel targeted by that idea. And it's something we have to look at. I would say this, and I said it earlier today at a speaking engagement I have. Given this country's history, Chris, when it comes to voter rights and how long it was restricted and how far some have gone to disallow people from voting, the fact that so many people died fighting for the right to vote, risk their lives, folks like Fannie Lou Hamer and others, you better have some concrete evidence of voter fraud, significant voter fraud that's changing elections before you start implementing or suggesting things that would make it harder for people to vote. Now, I'm not saying that there shouldn't be any rules and you can just walk up there and vote, but before you have a full effort on quote unquote voting reform, take some time to look at this country's history and make sure that you can back up your claims. And unfortunately, when I look at the bills in Georgia, when I look at what's going on here and other places, I just don't see that proof. I don't think they're upholding the standard that a true democracy should. But it's not all lost. I'd like to give a shout out to Lieutenant Governor Jeff Duncan here in Georgia. He is a Republican lieutenant governor here. And he went on Meet the Press this last Sunday, and he told the truth. He told the truth in a way that's sure to upset some of the people in his party, which, as y'all know, we think is necessary for all public officials to do it from time to time. Let me give you one of his quotes. He said that Republicans don't need election reform to win. We need leadership. He said, I think there's millions of Republicans waking up around the country that are realizing that Donald Trump's divisive tone and strategy is unwinnable in forward-looking elections. He goes on. He said he disagreed with ending the no-excuse absentee voting. He said that he's one of the Republicans that want more people to vote, that he thinks that Republican ideas will help people so they don't have to prevent people who don't look like them or who they don't think will vote for them from voting. He said he wants to expand voting, and he called many of the voting reform proposals solutions in search of a problem. Chris, what are your thoughts on some of these state voting reform efforts and just all that's going on after this Stop the Steal effort that was pretty much started with former President Trump?
Yeah, I mean, I think that this has all of the, the kind of very terrible handwriting on it that you don't want to see in a nation like the United States that has the sort of history that you talked about with voter suppression. But I also look at this and you see, in my opinion, bad political strategy. And I think it starts with, you know, kind of like the Trump response to some of the voting changes that were put in place because of COVID-19. Some of these reforms, though, that make it easier for people to vote were things that many of us who have been concerned with increasing civic participation for a long time, we've been talking about, no excuse absentee voting and increasing, early voting and all those types of things, making it easier to vote, in my opinion, has always been a good thing. And instead of, Trump and the Republicans under Trump taking that COVID moment and saying, yes, let's lean into this. Let's send, information out to Republican voters to make sure that they know how to vote early and vote absentee. You know, they doubled down on this election day strategy, which is like, I don't know, like, is that a good thing? Maybe that's why you lose the election, right? If you look at this race, like, there's a sizable popular vote gap, but a few, votes here and there, you flip some states and you keep the presidency. And I think it was a mistake not to lean into this this open vote philosophy. Again, not to make it where anybody can just walk up and vote in any way, but making it more accessible for folks who should be voting to vote, in my opinion, is a good thing. Now you go to the Senate runoff in Georgia. You lean into Stop the Steal. The election was stolen. You can't trust, electoral officials, even in a state like Georgia, where those officials are Republicans. You know, the White House was telling Republicans that they can't trust that. Republicans don't show up to the polls. Republicans lose both Senate seats. Bad strategy. Now you're continuing to lean into this, and you're ignoring the fact that Donald Trump did not lose the presidency because a disproportionate number of low income black and brown people went to the polls and voted for Joe Biden. Donald Trump lost the presidency because white men who have voted for Donald Trump swung over to Joe Biden. Now, if that's the reality, if I'm a Republican strategist, I'm looking at, man, how can we lean into this idea that you do find in Trumpism, right? That is this idea of kind of rejecting some of that old school Reagan economic policy. You know, at least you saw him leaning into rhetorically a kind of conservative populism on economic stuff. How do we take that and detach it from the crazy stuff and start to build a coalition you know, that looks different, but that there is room to build. I mean, even I'm going to go back to that Rubio article for a second, because he uses a phrase in that article that I think Republicans have used for a while, but don't really understand. Because there's this line in the Rubio piece where he talks about working class values, people who embrace working class values. I think what he intends to say is something that I don't think he's really necessarily tapped into in that article, or that Republicans have tapped into altogether. But there is a set of values, I would maybe call them traditional values, that actually work really well in everyday life, especially when you juxtapose them to some of the more extreme kind of left-leaning cultural values that are simply less attainable the less money you have, right? Some of that stuff just doesn't work if you're not rich. And it's not necessarily all about, you know, faith and religion, even though folks' faith play into this in a big way. But there is this idea that some of these values are important to folks because it's how life works well every day. And some of these things that we talk about just don't work real well for everyday people. And so there's a coalition, a future looking coalition that Republicans could be building that I think Democrats are leaving a wide opportunity for Republicans right now to build. And, you know, the Republicans just won't go for it. That lieutenant governor from your state, you know, rightly called these reforms solutions in search of a problem. And I think it's absolutely that, right? Like, you're solving the wrong problem. And it's horrible to me, because I think you should see Republicans solving the right problem, which is, how do we build a different kind of coalition? I think it's there, but they just won't do it.
You hit on something, which was, this was bad faith and also bad strategy. I mean, the stop the steal rhetoric basically lost the Senate for them, and could continue to do that. And people now have to cater to this stop the steal mentality. And in catering to that mentality, you're losing credibility with folks who might have considered voting for you. But now they see you going through all this stuff to try to stop people from voting. And the other thing is, a lot of Democrats just aren't that excited about the Democratic Party. So if you didn't see it as a foregone conclusion that folks, that others and minorities were just going to vote for Democrats, you might have an opportunity to win some of those votes, but you've already conceded and you've shown that you don't want to compete. You just don't want to compete. And I think one of the worst things you can do is do that in voting, because that's the worst form of cheating in a civic space. You know, what could you do more than cheating in the civic space more than stopping somebody from voting? Or coming up with these, you know, creative reasons why you need extra safeguards that include making sure that people who aren't in your constituency have a harder time voting. It's really unfortunate. And I do want to mention that, again, it's not all Republicans, right? You do have folks like Lieutenant Governor Jeff Duncan and others who are saying, come on, we can do this in a better way. And I've also been in situations when I ran for delegate. And we brought tons of people when I ran to be a delegate at the Democratic National Convention. I had Democrats trying to not count some of my voters. So it's not necessarily a partisan. It depends on who's winning and who may lose from it. Don't just assume that Democrats would never do something like this, but they're not doing it now, so you can't count it against them. I'm just saying, I've experienced where even some folks with blue on didn't necessarily want to count all the votes when it meant that they were going to lose. So we just have to watch out for this, man. Look into the history of when it comes to voter rights. We've talked about this before. It's nothing to play with. And I'll let Chris take us out on this topic.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you have to look to the history because that's important. But you also have to look at the present and the future. You know, when you talk about not letting folks vote on Sunday, I mean, I just led the church here in Chicago into this, what we call a service Sunday strategy. 3 Sundays out of the month, we go out after a 1-hour gathering and do some kind of service and outreach in the community. I can completely imagine, you know, around election time, having a whole parade to the polls. And so engaging with churches and other organizations in this way, like, I think the way for Republicans to find the future is to really force Democrats to defend some of their ideas. I think if you can do that, you'd be surprised to learn that demographics are not destiny, because there is a lot of kind of ideological diversity, you know, in every kind of demographic constituency. So, you know, a word to those who would want to help the Republican Party. And I think it's good for America to have a strong Republican Party that's moving in the right direction. And I think if you want to do that, there's some internal searching that needs to be done a lot more than trying to suppress people's right to vote.
Man, that is a word. Don't be afraid to compete, folks. We got one more topic to discuss, and we'll be right back. Are you too progressive for conservatives and too conservative for progressives? As a Christian, do you find yourself feeling politically homeless? If so, then you're not alone. Listen, this is Justin Gibney, president of the AND campaign. And if you're a Christian who doesn't know a whole lot about politics, or someone who knows a good deal about politics but wants to be more faithful in the public square, then you have to read the AND campaign's book, Compassion and Conviction. The AND Campaign's Guide to Faithful Civic Engagement, that we publish with InterVarsity Press. Whether you just want to understand the relationship between church and state, why Christians should engage politics at all, how Christians should engage partisanship, politics and race, advocacy and protest, or even civility, this is the book for you. It's very much Bible-centered. It's Bible study and small group friendly. There are questions and exercises after every chapter that give you a framework for engaging politics in a biblical way. So if you want to do it in a better way, get our book, Compassion and Conviction, the AND Campaign's Guide to Faithful Civic Engagement.
And we are back on the Church Politics Podcast. You with Justin Gibney and Christopher Butler. So we've been talking a little bit. We just got finished talking about kind of how some of the troubles that the Republicans have. Here's a problem for the Democrats, really for everybody, but certainly for this administration. They're going to have to figure it out. It looks like we are headed swiftly for another emergency at the border. A New York Times article paints a pretty bad picture of what's going on at the Mexican border. Maria Abi Habib wrote an article in the New York Times entitled On Mexico's Border with U.S. Desperation as Migrant Traffic Piles Up. And I just want to start by reading you some of the quotes from this article, which I think speak for themselves. Here we go. The migrants' hopes have been drummed up by human smugglers who promised that President Biden's administration will welcome them. Instead, the United States is expelling them back to Mexico, where they wait along with tens of thousands of others hoping to cross. Near the crossing with El Paso, Texas, a group of mothers and fathers clutching their children were sobbing as they walked back into Mexico from the United States on Saturday. They walked unsteadily and sneakers too loose after their shoelaces were confiscated and discarded along with all their personal items when they were detained by the United States Customs and Border Protection. Biden promised us, cried one woman. Many of the migrants said they had spent their life savings and had gone into debt to pay coyotes, who are human smugglers, who had falsely promised them that the border was open after President Biden's election. The United States is doing this under a federal order known as Title 42. The order, introduced by Mr. Trump, but embraced by Mr. Biden, justifies rapid expulsions as a health measure amid the pandemic. But cramming migrants into airplanes and overcrowded detention facilities without any coronavirus testing defeats the purpose of Title 42, many observers say. Chris, to hear the lies that some of these migrants are being told, the fact that they've spent their whole, and sometimes it costs $9,000 to travel from, you know, from parts of Mexico or South America, Central America here. To hear these stories, to hear folks having to give away, you know, even their shoelaces and just dreams crushed. It just brings us to the reality that we have to get comprehensive immigration reform done. Now, a story like this would likely be bigger, would likely be reported differently had it been Trump. We haven't, I mean, now Biden's just starting, but because of some of his rhetoric and all that stuff, Trump got hit for stuff like this really, really hard. And unfortunately, I think in some instances, number one, Trump could have done a lot better. So we're not going to defend any of those things. But in a way, it almost seems like, Chris, Democrats have set unreasonable expectations of what can go on at the border. And not only are folks wrong for any inhumane treatment that happens on the border, but also wrong for any bad messaging that went out based on just trying to win a political battle. And so you see these people caught up in these lies, caught up in this back and forth, and these are their lives, and they're trying to figure out what to do and where to go from here. Chris, what are your thoughts just about this general dynamic and how the Biden administration should handle this moving forward? They're going to have to do some things that the left, the far left, that maybe that probably isn't very realistic about this issue aren't going to like. But they also have to be humane. And how are they going to go about this? And what do you think the next steps are? How does this end?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I mean, I think that in order to get to where you need to get on this, and even as you're just talking, I'm remembering conversations, you know, when I was doing my Parent Power Chicago work, had a chance to meet several families who immigrated here and who had families who are still trying to get here. And when you know those stories, this is not a game. And I think for decades here, folks in both parties have really treated it like a game. And to get to a comprehensive approach to immigration reform, you're going to do things that make the left upset. You're going to do things that make the right upset. But these are human people. And I think that needs to mean more to us as Americans. You know, I am a proud American, but not being an American citizen doesn't make a person less human. And when our policies are impacting the lives of humans, we got to think about that. And we have to do what you said, Justin. We got to be humane. You know, so you have to sit down and figure this out. I think there is an approach. I think that the way forward on this has been pointed out by a lot of folks. I just think that it's the kind of thing that there's not the political will to do because of the fact that it doesn't totally please the extremes in either party's base. No party is willing to really champion real, true, comprehensive immigration reform and not just talk about it, but actually do it. And it's because the extremes and the bases won't be pleased by this. And the people who have to sit around in their living rooms if they're here in the United States and shed tears. I mean, I've seen it and been a part of it. And the folks who you described, Justin, from that article, you know, holding their children and walking back into, you know, Mexico with none of their, you know, with their literal dreams crushed. Those folks are not swinging the election. Is really, you know, one of these things that's important to me because it is the kind of thing that for those of us who are believers, when you think about how we treat the least of these, how we treat the foreigner and the stranger, that stuff that's in our text, right? Like that is in the text of Scripture, and it should move us in real ways to pressure folks to really get this solved. I'll say this and then I'll leave it. But, you know, you alluded to it, Justin, but I haven't seen yet the word cages in any coverage. I see detention facilities. I haven't been to the border, but I have to imagine that we haven't built in the last 3 weeks as the number of migrant people who are in custody has tripled. I don't think that we built a whole bunch of new detention facilities, but all of a sudden now in the press, they're no longer cages, they're detention facilities. And so that kind of imbalance, I don't think serves to really move this administration to quickly get to a real solution that works for people. So I would love to see more straightforward coverage of this, like we might see were there a different president in the White House. Because we have to get this solved. It is a horrible stain on our moral condition as a country to have this perpetually happening to people. And I think that's the key for us. Like, just because somebody is not an American citizen does not mean that they are not a human being. It's happening to people, and it's happening at our border, and it's happening on our watch. And we can do something about it, and we should.
Yeah, man. I mean, this is a crisis. We need to feel that urgency. And our responses have to be more than build the wall or don't build the wall, right? Based on the rhetoric that we heard all through the Democratic primary, all through, you know, all these conversations, you would have never thought there was one thing that Trump did that Biden would go along with. And now we see when you're faced with the reality, it is different. Now, again, this is not defending Trump. He said a lot of things he shouldn't have. He did not deal with the border properly. But that doesn't mean that the rest of us who may disagree don't have to deal with the reality that it is a tougher conversation than we would necessarily like. You know, I was at some points disgusted by how immigration was talked about on the Democratic primary stage. The idea that you didn't really have to think through it. You just say, hey, just let folks through. And when you talk like that, you create a situation on the border. You're hurting the people that you say that you're trying to help. You're making people think that they're just going to be able to come in and walk around and do whatever. And that's not going to be the case. People are spending their life savings, everything they have to get up here. Because we want to be in this utopia where there's no competing goods here, or there's no issues that we might have to really work hard to figure out. We want to say what the base wants to hear, which is Trump's bad. Let's do the opposite of what he did. And now we're figuring out that's not going to be the case. I'm going to be very prayerful that Biden administration, that everybody in Washington finds the right solution. This is going to be somewhat painful. The benefits of coming up with a compromise that could actually work aren't going to be as great as other policies that could fire up the base. But guess what? Sometimes you just have to do things because they're the right thing to do. Have we lost that sense, Chris? It's just unfortunate, man. So I'll let you have the last word and then we'll break out of here, man.
Yeah, I mean, I'll just say, you know, because you asked the question, and I'll just try, in order to get to comprehensive immigration reform, you've got to have components of it that lay the rules. It's not necessarily going to be easy. It's probably not going to be easy. There's going to be things that folks have to do, and there will be requirements. But I think if you make the rules clear and public, that is the only way you ever get an organized, approach to the sport, right? And I say this is not a game. I'm using this sporting metaphor. But you can't play organized sports. I don't know why I keep talking about organized sports, because Justin, you're the sports guy. I'm not that guy. But I watch a lot of organized sports, and you can't get the game going until the rules are clear and made public, right? And I think that is the basic thing that folks are looking for. What is the path to citizenship? How does it work? Make it clear, make it public, so that folks can begin to move forward instead of, you know, gassing people up with a bunch of false promises that were never, ever, ever going to be tenable to keep. I hope we do it. I'm going to be prayerful with you, Justin. I hope that we can get to it because it's horrible.
What's happening. Yeah, man. We need it. Well, as always, Ann Camp, there is a cross that neither political conservatism nor progressivism is fit to bear. There's a civic hearing in need of faithful witnesses who love social justice and won't surrender the truth to be loved by the world. Politic with the boldness and compassion of Jesus Christ. Until next time, Ann Camp. Well, I'll let you. Kingdom, kingdom. Oh, Lord, I say kingdom. Kingdom. Come through me, rest in me, kingdom.
This episode was brought to you in part by the audio adventure series Discovery Mountain. Help your kids fall in love with the Bible. Each true-to-life adventure story will draw them closer to Jesus. Visit discoverymountain.com/CT.